One, two, three, four.
Song Salad
with Shannon and Scott.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We had a little technical difficulty with Shannon's mic on this episode. Nothing so bad that we needed to bring in Robo Shannon, but listen to this little clip of audio from today's episode that is a little bit prophetic coming from Shannon.
And then I guess it does kind of get more and more poppy as you go.
Yes, it does, Shannon. Yes, it does. Anyway, here's the episode. Sorry about that. Welcome to Song Salad with Shannon and Scott.
I'm Shannon.
And I'm Scott.
And together,
we're putting on our best morning radio voices possible, I guess.
Yeah. We're sleepy peepers today.
Whoa. Sleepy peepers.
I couldn't think of something that rhymed with sleepy in a way that could also be made as like a reference, whatever.
Sleepy sheepy?
We're sleepy sheepies. Are we sheepies?
I don't know.
We're as much sheepies as we are peepers, I suppose.
You know what? We're sheepies because you can count on us.
Oh, God.
How's that?
Well, we've found it, ladies and gentlemen. The lowest point of the episode. We got it out of the way.
Started it early.
Yeah. Oh, geez. And what are we doing here, Scott?
We are recording Song Salad. We spin the salad spinner to get a random genre of music and a random topic from Wikipedia and combine them to create a pleasurable song.
That's pretty accurate. I say pleasurable parentheses, question mark, and parentheses. is how I would punctuate that sentence. I don't think we have any. Do we have any announcements?
Well, I have an update on the hauntings around here.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so for those of you who maybe didn't listen to last week, which, like, that's fine because we don't do anything that needs to be listened to in a sequence. But Scott was having some sort of paranormal activity in his apartment in San Diego where he was finding things misplaced. And then he ended the story without any kind of like, and then I found out it was this thing. And so it was very scary.
So I don't want to disappoint you, but I still have no answers for...
No, Scott, this is not an update.
You just wait for it. I have no answers for what happened to me, but nothing has happened to me since. So I guess I'm in the clear. I don't know. But...
worst story.
But Yankee, my boss who lives a couple doors down, told me that he started hearing voices in the middle of the night.
Oh my God, what?
And he realized they were coming from his living room. So he got up and his TV had turned itself on.
Seriously?
Yep.
You guys need to get out of there.
So that's the latest update in Spook Watch 2017.
Spook Watch. That is truly awful. I don't know that I would be able to, like, continue.
Just with life?
Yeah, I would just be like, well, I guess I'm going to the other side now. And I would just join, I would join the ghosts.
Hey, if they asked me to join, I'd join. They haven't asked me.
You should do, a seance type thing, like we did at the Jamel Mansion.
Just get into, like, EMF detector.
Yeah.
I should do a like ghost hunt in my apartment.
Yes. Yes, you should. And you should film it and then put it up on our Twitter.
Okay. So that's my weekly update. I guess next week I'll update more if anything else happens.
All right, great. Sounds good.
Yeah. Other than that, I think we're ready to jump in here.
Yeah, let's get our genre. I couldn't remember for a second which one came first. Let's get our genre.
Our salad spinner suggestion this week comes from Translocation Man at Matthew RMCD on Twitter.
And thank you, says, Matthew.
Your best fart sound using your forearm and your mouth.
Oh, no thank you, Matthew.
Are you going to pass on this one?
No, of course I'm going to try it. I don't think it's going to go well. Does everyone remember my elephant noise?
I was just going to bring that up, yeah.
Yeah, it was an elephant, right?
Yeah, it was an elephant dubstep.
Yes, that's right, from Douglas. No, it's not going to go super well, folks, but like I can definitely try it.
I think you should go first.
All right. Here we go. Spinning the salad spinner. Here is my best fart sound using my elbow.
I thought that was a better success than your elephant, for sure.
Yeah, it definitely was.
Our genre this week is post-grunge.
Post-grunge.
Post-grunge is a style of rock music that began in the 1990s and is considered a
Whoa, slow down, Scott.
It's too early.
Took that corner a little quickly, didn't you?
And is considered a subgenre of alternative rock and hard rock. Originally, post-grunge was an informal and even pejorative label used to describe bands that emulated the grunge sound of Nirvana and Pearl Jam, such as Bush, Candlebox, and Collective Soul. In the late 90s, post-grunge morphed into a more clearly defined style that married the sound and aesthetic of grunge with a more mainstream approach. Post-grunge rose to prominence in the 90s and continued to remain popular in the 2000s. Post-grunge bands such as Foo Fighters, Puddle of Mud, Stained, Nickelback, Creed, and Matchbox 20 all achieved mainstream success.
I have some thoughts about this.
Yeah, tell me.
First is that I don't know that I ever would have put Matchbox 20 on this list.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe they had a more grungy side I'm not aware of that was away from their mainstream hits.
Yeah, they feel Matchbox 20 to me, and I'm probably going to say this, and then everyone who is much more of a music head who listens to this is going to take to Twitter. Fly, monkeys, fly. Matchbox 20 kind of seemed to me like if Green Day were just started by older guys. Does that make any sense what I just said?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
I don't know. But I mean, Green Day is great too. It's very nostalgic about Green Day. But in any case, Matchbox 20 feels like the outlier there.
And of
like
that I can, list, yes.
Yes,
for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
And like I can kind of see the connective threads between Foo Fighters, Puddle of Mud, Stained. And then I guess it does kind of get more and more poppy as you go, right? Nickelback, Creed, Matchbox 20.
I guess but like, so, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, all of these bands had like, you know, Billboard pop hits in the 90s when that was like in vogue, but definitely Matchbox 20 I put in a closer category to like, I don't know, even to bands like Smash Mouth than like Foo Fighters, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know, let's keep reading.
Yeah, so what does post-grunge sound like?
During the 90s, post-grunge emerged with a sound that emulated the attitudes of grunge music, particularly its thick, distorted guitars, but with a more commercially accessible tone. This also says that post-grunge music tends to be a mid-tempo, typically, for people to be able to latch onto it a little bit better, and it's noted for having a polished, radio-ready production rather than true grunge bands, which are a little bit freer. Grierson of About.com, thanks Grierson, wrote that musically, post-grunge bands split the difference between plaintive ballads and aggressive rockers, resulting in songs that combine the two extremes into a sad-eyed, propulsive middle ground.
Sad-eyed, propulsive middle ground. How lyrical for About.com, huh?
I know. Usually, post-grunge songs have the same structures as pop songs. And also, there's a little bit about lyrics here.
Yeah, I see that. So, A major rift between grunge and post-grunge is in the lyrical substance of the music. Grunge expressed emotion through loose metaphors or third-person narratives, while post-grunge was known for being direct and blunt. While describing lyrics that are common in post-grunge, Sasha Geffen of Consequence of Sound, not of About.com, so don't know if we can trust it, wrote that post-grunge plunged directly into the I, like I, the first person pronoun, not your own
right.
Seeing balls. Geffen wrote that most post-grunge songs that achieve mainstream success call after a prospective or past companion in the first person. Okay, so like directly talking to another person, probably angrily, I guess. Post-grunge lyrics also tend to be about topics such as relationships, no kidding, romance, and drug addiction. Cool.
Great.
According to Geffen, grunge's frontmen posed with their addictions. Post-grunge's songwriters sought redemption for them. Also, according to Geffen, Alanis Morissette, No Doubt, Sarah McLachlan all crystallized the songwriting strategy that would form the emotional core of the post-grunge movement.
Right. Yeah. Thinking about the I and calling after a specific like person in your songs, Alanis Morissette and like Jagged Little Pill
is perfect for this. For sure.
Yeah. There's a lot of info about the history here. I'm kind of scanning through it to see what a good example would be.
Yeah, that was my next question. What example should we use?
There's a lot. Do you want to do Nickelback?
Yeah, let's pick a super classic.
Their like biggest hit was How You Remind Me.
Oh my god, yeah.
So here it is.
Oh, so good.
For everyone's listening pleasure. You know, we had to do a content warning for clowns last week. We're going to have to do a content warning for Nickelback this week.
I know, seriously. I can already hear our friend Steven screaming.
So this is How You Remind Me by Nickelback. Oh, that song.
Everybody remembers where they were the first time they heard How You Remind Me by Nickelback.
For good or for bad.
Yeah. I definitely remember dancing to that song at like middle school dances in our darkened cafeteria.
It's like, why was that even played at dances?
I don't know.
You don't dance to it.
It was so popular, though.
It was. It was everywhere. That was 2001, we were just saying, if anyone needed a reminder.
And this is how you remind me, Scott?
Oh, God.
That it was 2001.
This is how I remind you that it was 2001.
But that's actually a good example of a post-grunge song directly addressing a person or a companion, past or present, right? Talking about the pain of that relationship.
Self-analyzing and, you know, like I was saying about addictions and seeking salvation.
Yeah. Being very self-critical and kind of like emo in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. He even has the lyric been down to the bottom of every bottle, you know?
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just like remembering the song now. And it's like, oh, God, it's so bad.
I've been wrong.
To the bottom of every bottle.
Yep.
Okay.
Oh, I can't wait to sing this.
So good. All right.
What you just heard is my post-grunge voice.
Let's get our topic.
Yeah.
And it's your turn to make the best fart sound that you can.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
I just did. It was me singing Nickelback.
Yeah.
All right. Here we go.
Okay. Whoa. Several things about that. First, it was very long. Second, you need to listen back to the tape because I don't know if you could hear it, but you like had some harmonics in there. I don't know. Like, seriously, there were like two tones of the fart and they like.
I'm going to go into professional arm farting.
Yeah. Well done, Boo.
Thanks. What'd we get?
We got supper at a mouse.
A mouse?
Supper at a mouse. A mouse.
A mouse.
Parentheses Caravaggio, comma, Milan, end parentheses.
Do tell.
So, Supper at a Mouse, 1606, is a painting by Italian master Caravaggio, housed in the Pinacoteca de Brera, Sala XXIX. In Milan. So, okay. So, Pinacoteca de Brera.
De Brera.
It
must be a museum.
A museum. And then Sala, whatever the number is the room that it's in the museum in Milan. So, this says that by 1624, so it was painted in 1606. By 1624, it was in the collection of Marchese Patrizi and possibly also commissioned by him. And it was painted a few months after May 1606, when the artist was in hiding on the estates of Prince Marzio Colonna following the death of Ranuccio Tomassoni.
Let's look up why he was in hiding.
And like why, I don't know why that guy's death would mean that a painter has to go in hiding, but we'll find out. Although it may have also been painted in Rome earlier in the year. So here's what we're looking at with this painting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually kind of confusing because there are two different versions of it, both of which were done by Caravaggio.
Hmm. Yeah.
So there's one done in 1601, and then there's a second one, which seems to be the, like, I guess it seems to be the more famous one, right?
It looks like it.
Yeah, that was done in 1606. So they both show the moment in the Bible when the two disciples meet Christ again and recognize Christ.
And the resurrection, yeah.
After the resurrection, right, yeah. Right. It wasn't just like Tuesday or whatever. It was like, oh my God, he's back from the dead.
Easter Tuesday,
you know. It is Easter this week, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's Easter today. Happy Easter, everyone. Literally Easter today. Cool. Happy Easter.
No, it's not.
Isn't it?
No, next week.
Oh, never mind.
It's the 16th.
Oh, I became unstuck in time for a moment because I really thought today.
You're not the only person that thought that, though.
That's crazy. Okay.
I have information about his exile. Do you want to talk about that or do you want to keep going with the painting for now?
Let's put a pause on the painting. Tell me why he was exiled.
So, Caravaggio apparently was notorious for brawling.
Mm.
And on May 29th, 1606, he killed, possibly unintentionally, but no one really knows, a young man named Ranuccio Tomassoni.
Oh.
The circumstances of the brawl and the death remain mysterious. It could have been a gambling debt or a tennis game that went wrong. People don't really know. So anyway, he killed this guy and fled to Naples, which was outside the jurisdiction of Roman authorities, and he was protected by the family of this Marchese di Colonna, or that's not right.
No?
Marzio Colonna.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the family protected him and commissioned him for a bunch of paintings while he was in hiding with them.
Oh my God. That's so bonkers. Yeah, all right, Caravaggio, like,
it also says he might have been gay.
Oh God. What an interesting dude.
Because he drew full-lipped, languorous boys.
says?
Who seemed to solicit the onlooker with their offers of fruit, wine, flowers, and themselves.
Oh, geez. Imagine, imagine, like, being so uptight about people being gay that, like, you couldn't just draw men without people being like, gay, gay. He's definitely gay.
Well, it says he never painted a female nude and instead just drew a lot of full-lipped, languorous boys.
Okay, this week we promise that we'll tweet some full-lipped, languorous boys for all of you to enjoy. Not going to yuck any yums there. Okay.
All right, so that's Caravaggio in a nutshell, and we have a specific painting of his about this Gospel of Luke moment.
Yes. So there are two versions of this painting, as we were alluding to before. One of them is in London, and one of them is this second one. So this second painting, Wikipedia talks about, there is an inevitable comparison with the one that's in London because it's literally of the same subject, but they're very different paintings. So the main differences are, so both paintings are people sitting around a table staring in amazement at Jesus. And in the first, they're like kind of big, crazy gestures. Like one of the disciples has his arms like completely outstretched and like he kind of looks like shocked. And mm-hmm. Jesus is also making a gesture like, hey, what's up? And in the second, and it's also of a lighter tone. And in the second one, Wikipedia calls the gestures understated and natural. And it's a much darker painting. Like the shadows are like really, really dark on it. Mm-hmm. And it almost is like the people are kind of just like emerging from blackness. Like that's how dark the shadows are. So there's less of a sense of there being like a room around them than there is in the first one. The effect of this, according to Wikipedia, is to emphasize presence more than drama. Mm-hmm. And then some details, which are kind of interesting here. The ear of the disciple on the right, in the 1606 version, the right hand of the innkeeper's wife remain badly drawn, but there is a fluidity in the handling of the paint, which was to increase in Caravaggio's post-Roman work as his brushwork became increasingly calligraphic.
Hmm.
How in the world would you say calligraphic?
Calligraphic.
Calligraphic.
I guess.
Cool. The artist may have had problems working out his composition. The innkeeper's wife looks like a last-minute addition. Neither she nor the innkeeper are mentioned in the Gospel of Luke, which is where this scene comes from in the Bible, but had been introduced by Renaissance painters to act as a foil to the amazement of the two disciples as they recognize the resurrected Christ.
Hmm.
So that's interesting that they wanted to put these like two people there that like didn't really have anything to do. They were just looky-loos, you know?
Right.
And you know, it is like kind of weird, I have to say, that in the second painting, it doesn't really appear that anything remarkable is happening.
No. And the innkeeper and his wife are like the most well-lit figures.
Yeah.
And are drawn with much more detail than Jesus or the disciples.
Yeah. The disciples more or less have their backs completely turned to us. So you can't even see their faces. Jesus is half in shadow. And then the innkeeper and his wife are standing over them at the table, like peering down in like boredom, basically like, I really just want to take your order. Can like you please stop talking? So we'll tweet a picture of this, obviously. So you can kind of see. And I see what they mean by the innkeeper's wife being a last minute addition. Like you really see, because of that like deep shadow effect that I mentioned earlier, you really only get like a little sliver of this woman. It's
basically like a bust of an innkeeper's wife.
Yeah, kind of like hovering over the other people. So maybe not like a super, I mean, the skill is obviously incredible, but like the composition is kind of like, if you looked at that, I don't know that you would know what it was supposed to be or that anything was even going on. Like, honestly,
it doesn't look that interesting.
it looks like it was part of like a much larger painting, and this is like a zoomed in corner of like just some random dudes at a table talking shop, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not great. Okay. So that's my super informed art critique art of Caravaggio.
There you go.
So Caravaggio, like dragging Caravaggio. Here's why I think this is a good topic.
Tell me.
Because I think that there is a lot of room in this scene that has been painted for direct and personal address lyrics.
True.
Because I think I could do it either from like one of the innkeeper wife looky-loos perspective. Yep. Or I could definitely do it from a disciple's perspective, because it's talking about, you know, relationships and like literally talking about redemption is a theme. And here we have like Christ being resurrected to like save people's sins, basically. So
Right. And I like that it's almost Easter and we're talking about a painting of the the aftermath of the resurrection.
Yeah, I agree. Okay.
Fitting. Why don't you gather some ideas from the painting for you know, a perspective to write from, and maybe look up some more post-grunge lyrics, and I'll do a little more post-grunge history and instrumentation research.
Cool, that sounds good. Okay, so I actually found that Sasha Geffen article that Wikipedia references, where she talked...
The Wikipedia
references, where she talks about the lyrics and how post-grunge changed from, you know, this kind of detached, metaphorical third-person narrative to more confessional, straightforward and direct narratives. That were often about relationships or addiction. And this article is actually very interesting, and we can tweet out this article as well. Boy, we have a lot on our Twitter queue.
We do.
This week. But she points out, and I think rightly, that there's no other period in recent music history that is so universally despised by people. And she actually talks about a guy who was writing for Chuck Klosterman was writing in an article that there are, over the past 20 years, there have been 5 bands totally acceptable to hate reflexively. and by totally acceptable, I mean that the casual hater wouldn't even have to provide a justification. He or she could just openly hate them and no one would question why. And Geffen says he's right on all 5. And they are Bush, Hootie and the Blowfish, Limp Bizkit, Nickelback, and Creed. And so three of the five are post-grunge bands. And she posits that it's because it was a really easy thing to hate, and they were all because it felt very contrived and formulaic, and all the bands really sounded the same. And so it seemed like for 5 years straight, it was just like one song playing on your car radio.
I was reading more about the transition between grunge and post-grunge and why it was so, you know, why post-grunge was created as a pejorative label.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Nirvana and Pearl Jam were kind of the height of the commercially known grunge scene. And Kurt Cobain died in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, people were already starting to talk about how grunge was dead and all this stuff. And then the couple early post-grunge bands that emerged right after Kurt Cobain's death were seen as sort of like jumping on the bandwagon of grunge. When all the other grunge bands were like, well, now that Cobain's gone, grunge is gone too.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Bush is described by a reviewer at Rolling Stone magazine as the most successful and shameless mimics of Nirvana's music. Another writer said Creed and Nickelback espoused a more conventional, almost conservative worldview than grunge, built around the comforts of community and romantic relationships. This attitude was diametrically opposed to the antisocial angst of the original grunge bands, who rallied against conformity and instead explored troubling issues such as suicide, societal hypocrisy, and drug addiction. Post-grunge was a profitable musical style, but bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam were beloved partly because of their perceived integrity in avoiding the mainstream, and post-grunge, by comparison, seemed to exist in order to court that very audience.
Ah.
So it kind of like swooped in and was like, we can make this popular.
Yeah. That makes sense.
So again, the justification for hating them is built into that attitude as well.
Yeah. I also found a little bit more information about the Supper at Emmaus. I was reading the article for the other Caravaggio painting, the one that hangs in London,
1601.
Yes, the 1601 version that's got a little bit more going on. And I just really love the way that the article describes the painting. And here it is. The painting depicts the moment when the resurrected but incognito Jesus reveals himself to two of his disciples, presumed to be Luke and Cleopas.
Cleopas?
Yeah, Cleopas. Cleopas?
Never heard of him.
I don't know. Yeah, me either. In the town of Emmaus, only to soon vanish from their sight. So I guess Jesus was dining with them in another form. So he was like shape-shifting and then like revealed himself in the moment to be Jesus and freaked them out.
Can Incognito Jesus be our band name?
I think Incognito Jesus has to be our band name. Sure.
For more inspiration and research, I listened, in addition to How You Remind Me, I listened to Kryptonite by Three Doors Down.
Yeah.
And With Arms Wide Open from Creed.
Yeah.
That banger.
Banger.
And, you know, musically, the structure of the band is pretty much like what you'd find in a traditional rock or grunge band, where it's mostly, you know, like two guitars with distortion on them, bass and drums. But I think what sets the post-grunge songs apart is that they will employ vocal harmonies in the chorus. They'll do things like in How You Remind Me, Nickelback, like in the chorus doing like, yeah. Oh, no. You know, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Creed even has strings in the background of With Arms Wide Open, which is definitely not a grunge thing to do.
Yeah, and I saw Lifehouse had flutes in one of their songs, actually.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of stepping out of the smaller, bare bones feeling of traditional grunge songs.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm kind of going back and forth on whether we should write a, like, driving, rockin' kind of a post-grunge song like Kryptonite, which is a pretty quick tempo, or should we do like a sentimental post-grunge ballad?
Yeah, I mean, that does seem to be the essential question here. And
yeah.
I would like to figure it out before I start writing lyrics.
Yeah.
I don't know. What's more interesting to you?
I think I like the way that the post-grunge ballads work is they kind of start out like quiet and subdued, and then like they keep their slower tempo, but then like the guitars start jamming in and like there's big cymbal crashes and things. So they're still, they get to a peak, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just so serious.
Yeah, they're they're so serious.
So I'm kind of leaning towards just like a big, like, sad ballad.
Okay, awesome. I'm 100% down for that.
We usually do up-tempo songs.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. All right.
Yeah?
I have lyrics.
I'm really excited about this one.
All right, so lyrics by the band Incognito Jesus. taken from the perspective of the disciple, one of the disciples at the table.
Who the one is, with the badly drawn ear?
Yeah, sure, that one. I'm not sure if that's Luke or Cleopas, whatever.
Cleopas.
Man, they are just so tired of being jerked around by Jesus. Keeps abandoning them.
Okay. Oh, no.
All right. Here we go. Sitting at this table, you've just disappeared like an old time fable from my younger years. Shouldn't be surprised. Shouldn't hurt like this. And I've realized some things I don't miss. And then the like big epic angsty chorus is because you're in and out of my life, here and gone again. You rise and fall, you never call, but you're telling me how to be a better man.
Oh, it's so good.
Thanks. I think it's like a good, I think it hits the right tone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it because it's like calling someone out on their bullshit, but also like, I can't stop loving you.
Yeah, yeah. But like it's like an addiction that you're trying to overcome.
Right. And very much driven by the I. And like, yes. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Did you have an idea for what it's called?
I don't know. There's not really a great...
I thought something jumped out at me.
What? What jumped out at you?
How to be a better man.
How to be a better man?
Yeah.
That's actually probably a pretty good post-grunge name for a song.
Yeah, How to Be a Better Man by Incognito Jesus.
Perfect.
So here is...
How to Be a Better Man.
By Incognito Jesus.
By Shannon and Scott.
Sitting at this table, you've just disappeared. Like an old-time fable. Shouldn't be surprised, shouldn't hurt like this. And I realize some things I don't miss. Because you're in and out of my life. Here and gone again. You rise and fall, you never call. But you're telling me how to be a better man. Oh, 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 oh. How to be a better man. Oh, 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 oh. How to be a better man.
I think that we have earned the hatred of our generation in the same way that that Nickelback and Creed and Lifehouse and the whole post-grunge movement does. This is one of those genres where like I think we kind of got it pretty close.
I think so too.
And it, I'm
pretty happy.
I credit that to being just steeped in this stuff during a time when my brain was like forming and growing and like making neural pathways and shit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And this was also like prime MTV TRL
oh,
time.
Oh my gosh. You know? Yeah.
So the music videos for these songs are pretty iconic as well.
Yes, 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 yes. Clearly made a very deep impression, so much so that Scott and I could just vomit one of these back up.
Yeah,
for
exactly.
All of you. Cool.
I think I'm gonna need to work on my my grunge voice though.
Yeah, I mean, you're no Scott Stapp, but
I'm trying too hard to affect it, you know? It doesn't come naturally to me to just have that grit in there.
The gravitas.
Yes, that Scott Stapp gravitas that we all crave.
Scott Stapp, that craveable gravitas from Scott Stapp. Oh my God. Very good.
I encourage everyone to Google Marlins Will Soar.
Marlins Will Soar?
Oh, remember seeing this?
Yep, I do. Yeah, we can tweet that called, right? Too. I think so.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll tweet that little treasure out also. And
so much tweeting to do.
I know. So you better follow us on Twitter at SongSaladCast. So
you'll
that
see
you can
all these fun things we've mentioned through the episode.
See all of our tweets. We do tweet an okay amount, I guess. We're not super great at tweeting, but
mostly on Mondays.
Yeah, mostly on Mondays. You can find us on Facebook also. If you like ever wanted to send us an email, which like I'm not sure why you would, but maybe you do, we're songsaladpodcast@gmail.com. And all of our information, including links to subscribe, is on songsaladpodcast.com.
Thank you, Translocation Man, for your salad spinner suggestion. And if you want to send one to us of your own, tweet it at us at songsaladcast.
And if you leave us a review on iTunes, reviews really help us get noticed. We will give you a shout out on the show.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. I'm just affirming you.
Thank you.
Until next week.
I'm Shannon.
And I'm Scott.
And together, we're
Incognito Jesus.
Yeah, that's right.
We need to start a new Twitter handle.
1, 2, 3, 4.